Coming up next, conversations on human rights with Speak Up, Kōrero Tia, here on Plains FM.
E nā mana, e nā reo, e nā hō e whā. Tēnā koutou katoa, no mai ki tēne hōtaka. Speak Up, Kōrero Tia. Tune in as our guests speak up, sharing their unique and powerful experiences and opinions. And may you also be inspired to speak up when the moment's right. Kia ora koutou, this is Speak Up Kōrero Tia, ko Sally Carlton tēnei. Today we're going to be talking about community-based food initiatives. Now this is a really big topic. There are all kinds of community-based food initiatives. We've got Kai Rescue, Food Hubs, Soup Kitchens, Mahinga Kai, Community Gardens, the list really goes on. They span a very, very vast spectrum, right from initiatives which try to implement change at the start of the food cycle. So people encouraging growing or gathering your own food, to initiatives which try to make it easier for all people to access affordable, good quality and locally produced kai, through to initiatives right at the other end of the spectrum, which rescue food, which would otherwise go to waste, divert out of landfill and to people in need. Our guests today will talk about initiatives across this spectrum, introducing us the different reasons for their mahi, but also the different outcomes and benefits from them. And there will be a lot, I'm sure. I think what we'll also find, though, is that even though these initiatives are very different, at their heart, they seek to create a more socially and ecologically just world. So, ko wai koutou, who are you? What's your mahi? What brought you to this place? What drives you? It would be really great to hear from each of you a little bit about yourselves and the work that you do. Gemma, how about we start with you?
Sure, perfect. Thank you. So my name's Gemma. I'm originally from the UK, here in Christchurch for a Visiting Erskine Fellowship at the University of Canterbury. So I've been here for this semester since August, primarily working in the Faculty of Health, working across public health, health systems, and exercise physiology with nutrition kind of thrown in there. But my background in terms of research from the UK is primarily looking at food systems, public health, nutrition, and kind of the conditions and complexities that relate to that. So food insecurity, obesity, struggle accessing benefits and welfare. And then today, primarily going to be talking about one of the research projects I've been working on most recently, which is looking at food hubs. So that's anything from social supermarkets, community gardens, community cafes, and everything in between. Looking at the impacts that they have in the community. So looking at the health impacts, looking at the economic, social, and sustainability and community development aspects of these organizations. And also talking about a toolkit that we produce with the organizations to better support them, evaluate their work, communicate that to policymakers and funders, and support their communities more sustainably into the future. So it's great to be here today. Looking forward to this conversation. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Gemma. Luisa, how about we hear from you?
Kia ora koutou, ko Luisa tōku ingoa no Ingarangi Ahau, kei whakatū ahau e noho ana. Ko te kai whakahaere o Kai Rescue me Hapori Ahau. So I work for Nelson Environment Centre in the role of coordinating our Kai Rescue programme, which collects surplus food from supermarkets, from producers, from wholesalers, from many, many places, and redistributes that to the community. I'm also responsible for organising part of our Hapori programme, which is a subscription fruit and veg box, locally grown produce, which is run by local growers and is open to anyone to kind of sign up to on a weekly basis. So those are our kind of the initiatives in the food space as part of Nelson Environment Centre. But the kaupapa that Nelson Environment Centre covers is actually really broad, and we have other programmes as well, but this is just our kind of food side of things. And in terms of the spaces that we're moving in, the Kai Rescue programme is very different to what Hapori offers. So Kai Rescue is at the very, very end of that chain of how food is produced, consumed, sold in the community. And we are sitting between a dysfunctionality in the food production system and a dysfunctionality in our social space, where we have a large number of people in our community that are food insecure and can't afford to feed themselves well with the current cost of living and many other factors. Whereas Harpori is something which is not in the kind of remedial space, as it were, dealing with two kind of slightly dysfunctional aspects of the system. But Harpori is trying to promote support of our local growers and promote more food resilience and make things accessible for really great quality produce. That's kind of a bit of information on our paper.
Is Harpori almost like a social enterprise?
Not exactly, but it wouldn't be wrong to kind of put it in that bracket. Yeah. It's run by Nelson Environment Centre, not for profit, and we have volunteer involvement with that, and we also have local grocers that work with us to select the produce each week and send it out. And so the price of those boxes goes back to paying for the goods and paying the grocers, whereas in between we get some funding to help run the program, but it's not at profit.
Perfect. Great. Thank you very much. And Christina, our final guest.
Kia ora koutou katoa. He uri a hau no Ngāti Porou, Ngāti Kahununu me Ngāi Tūhoe, e nari e nohana hau I o tautahi. So my name's Christina Makucha and I live here in Christchurch, although in terms of my whakapapa, it's to the east coast of the North Island. And I am an academic at the University of Otago based in Christchurch, and I teach in public health, Haora Māori, and that is where my research has always been. I've got a background in human nutrition because my mum was a Māori dietitian, and so I've always been interested in kai and I guess how our people can eat healthy kai, and so that's how I became interested in access to kai and the wider food system, and that's where a lot of my research has focused. So I'm interested both in policy, but also interested in how that policy translates at local levels in our Māori communities.
Really cool. And I saw in the news, actually, that you are involved in a project around Mahinga Kai, particularly after the storms up north.
Yeah, we were really lucky. I worked with another Ngāti Porou researcher, and we applied for funding really so we could do some research based where we both whakapapa to on the east coast of the North Island, looking at those kai systems that are in those remote communities on the east coast of the North Island, the impacts of the cyclone on that for people and on people's mental health, and I guess how the East Coast can work towards greater food resilience rather than being cut off all the time. You know, there was a period during the cyclones where if I wanted to get back to either of my marae, I would not have been able to. I would have had to take a helicopter and, you know, relations being cut off because not the supermarket, but the one food store in your little town's closed down. So the impact of climate change is very real.
I think even in your introductions to yourselves and your work, we've already touched on, I think, a lot of the themes that are probably going to come through. We've touched on the social, the environmental, the economic systems that sort of underpin food and food resilience and food systems. We're going to have our first break and our first waiata.
I always like the Maisie Rika one, Haumanu. It's all about the environment and sustainability and that kind of thing.
Ahi papa kura tina o a whenua, e oranga nuku, e oranga rangi e.
He mana mau, he mana tawa, he mana wa whenua, he oranga nuku, he oranga rangi e. Ma te hautawa o e pupuhi mai te, he homa.
We're talking about community-based food initiatives. We've just had a great song from Mesirika, and it would be great now to think about some of the different food initiatives that you're involved in. What is it that prompts these projects to be set up? What exactly are they? And also, what are the benefits or the outcomes that we're seeing at the end of them? And feel free to jump in and ask questions of each other as well, because you're all coming from quite different spots along this food system chain that we talked about at the beginning, but there'll be lots of parallels, I'm sure.
I'm happy to speak to your question about what are some of the benefits and what do we actually see as some of the outcomes. Speaking about what Kai Rescue does, I can say that there's a few layers to our impacts. The first and kind of most obvious is food doesn't get wasted, because we're rescuing anywhere between 3.5 to 5 tons of food per week. So there's an environmental impact to that in saving that from landfill. And then there's the social impact of people that are struggling in vulnerable positions, don't have food security, Kai being offered to them. So those are kind of, that's the first layer. But I'd say that the second layer is also about what we do in the community overall. So we have around 45 volunteers that are brought together through our program. And we also have about 55 recipient organizations. So they are the organizations that pick up the pie from us and then distribute it to their networks. So we're a hub in creating community, not only through our volunteers, but also through all of the organizations that are connected. Yeah, I'd say that's kind of like a second layer of our impact. We're able to acknowledge those positive results and be proud of them, pleased with them. But we also acknowledge that we would rather not be here doing this job. In an ideal world, this project wouldn't exist, because we wouldn't be seeing massive food waste and we wouldn't be seeing such a huge need in the community.
Well, I can jump in on that, I think. So the research that we've primarily been doing is UK, but I think having been in New Zealand for the past 3 months, I've seen a lot of crossover, and I've spoken to and worked with community gardens and community cafes. But in terms of the UK, the project we were doing was looking at food hubs, and we were talking about food hubs broadly. So as I mentioned, community cafes, community gardens, social supermarkets, redistribution centres, and everything in between. And these organisations, I think, as you were mentioning, they perform lots of different activities. They may redistribute food that's surplus. They may offer food aid, especially, for example, emergency food aid, like a food bank, or work in more of a kind of social supermarket food pantry model where people become members and access food for their family for the week at a more affordable cost. But in terms of the impacts that these organisations have, as Louisa mentioned, they're very broad, and it can be anything from enabling people to access food that's affordable or free and helping to reduce food waste, but also helping to produce that more direct link between producers and consumers, which in turn can help to reduce the food miles that food needs to be transported. Also helping like local small businesses to reach markets, building that kind of social capital and enhancing the community itself. And also looking at the health and well-being of communities by accessing food that's more affordable and hopefully more local, they are able then to focus on other things, not worry about where they're getting food from, and also making sure that they're able to access that food in a way that's kind of socially and culturally appropriate. But kind of to summarize those impacts, looking at like sustainability, the local economy, the local food system, so strengthening that, and also improving well-being. So I think there's pretty broad impacts of these organizations, and I think you can then go down into that and drill into that a lot more if we, through this conversation, we can look at that in more detail.
Kia ora. To add to the conversation about food hubs, I'm involved in a project at the moment, and it's actually up in Wellington, and it's with an urban marae in Wellington, a Mātā Waka marae. So the people from that marae are not necessarily mana whenua to Wellington. They do a lot of work with their community, and they've identified obviously the impacts of COVID and the cost of living crisis, meaning, you know, whānau are unable to access food and lots of people are in emergency housing, so it's kind of tricky to grow gardens when you're in motels. And so they've done a lot of work. They've got a wonderful food hub in Wainuiomata, which took them about 4 years to get set up. The people there were quite critical of the fact that, say, for example, alcohol outlets will take a week to get approval, but their food hub took, you know, 4 years. And they're growing marakai, like gardens, in order to provide kai for their pātaka kai, for their pantries. And they're kind of really into recolonising the urban spaces of Wainuiomata so that they have land to grow garden, and doing things like growing a lot of seeds so that they can give seedlings out to their community members to try and sort of get that cycle going, and also, you know, employ people. It is awesome to see it, but the hardest thing they're dealing with is funding, because measuring impact is difficult. So I'm super interested in the work that Gemma is doing, because I think at the moment things are being measured quite narrowly rather than broadly in terms of social impact. And so I am involved in supporting that work, and that's been really interesting. But I am mindful that I did some earlier work, some focus groups with Māori, about how people view sustainable food. And we also did focus groups with non-Māori. And what was really interesting was that even though there is agreement in terms of what sustainable food means, Māori would also go, well, what about haumea? What about rongo? Like, why are we only talking about food that is grown or food that is available in shops? Why aren't we talking about the broader environment where Māori traditionally got food from? And so there are also projects that are looking at restoring the native bush so that you can go and gather that bush kai. I found out about a really amazing project up in Gisborne where they're trying to pest trap so that you can bring back the feel, the blue duck, but also within that trapping, you're enabling the bush kai that normally would get eaten by some of our pest animals. So you're having access to things like kareao, which is supplejack, which is a really, really old food that, you know, people would have eaten 300 years ago. And also people are really interested in trying to restore the moana in the rivers. So you can still gather your kai moana, or you can go to your river or your lake and still get things like eel. And it's not going to be completely and utterly polluted. And so I've been finding out about some of those projects that many, many, many people are doing, especially down here in Christchurch. There's all these amazing mahinga kai restoration projects, which are using that really broad definition of where we get our food from. Yeah, it's super interesting. There's heaps happening. It's awesome.
Kia ora, Christina. I've got a thought in response to what you said about those projects, which is that I think the step that you've described that is happening from having hubs of food resilience to looking at the wider environment is essentially the step between food resilience to food sovereignty. And that's something which I'm sure, Gemma, you can speak a lot more to, but in terms of the end of the scale that we're operating at in our project, when we get asked about what we'd like to see as kind of solutions or improvements in the space, I actually believe that our end of the operation is not the answer, and that actually most of the answers happen way, way earlier in the food sovereignty situation, and that ultimately food sovereignty is a better goal than just food resilience or a kind of a low level immediate emergency food security option.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. So you were saying there, like, it would be nice for organizations like not to be here, but I do think there are some organizations that are doing great work in that space. So they're supporting communities to have a better understanding of what good food is, how to grow food. I mean, I think also in the UK especially, people are so far removed from where food is grown and what food looks like and how it's grown, that there's a big need to support people to understand, oh, this is how carrots are grown, or this is how tomatoes are grown, or whatever. And so these organizations are helping to almost move to that food sovereignty aspect. But I think we're so far away from it at the moment that there's a lot of work to be done. So it's great to hear that work is already happening in Christchurch in New Zealand around that, and around bringing people back to their food origins, I suppose, and that food sovereignty. And it's great to hear that that is possible. And I think there is work happening where there's community gardens and there's like steps being taken to move away from the emergency food aid, like redistribution, which is needed now because the welfare state and the benefits system isn't meeting the needs of communities. But I think it's also great to see that these community gardens and kind of that move towards where food is grown is happening. And it's just like, I think it's going to have to happen in parallel until we get to a point where the wider food system is less broken and we can all access food that is grown and is accessible in our kind of communities.
I've got another thought or question off the back of that. The shift towards more development of food sovereignty is something which depends on organisations that are helping to drive that change. As you pointed out, Gemma, there's a lot of work to be done there. It's not just a kind of, well, let's just focus on this now. There has to be a whole tide change with that. So it depends partially on the organisations. It depends on bigger systems, things about, you know, government funding and political direction. But also a huge part of that is people's attitudes and habits. And I think that one of the challenges that is present, whether it's, you know, in Aotearoa or in the UK, is that, as you said, Gemma, we've become so detached from most of our food system that there's not only a relearning, but there's a whole mindset shift to happen in our lifestyles. And I was curious to know if both of you have any comments to make about the ways in which that happens, who drives that change, and how it can also be culturally sensitive and not an imposition of government or organisations that believe that they know what is better for people's well-being and therefore are trying to induce mindset change.
Kia ora, Luisa. That's a really interesting question. There was a wonderful resource written by Hannah Burgess and Hayley Kudawi. and it's on the Toi Tangata website, and it's called Intergenerational Intimacies, a Whakapapa Conceptualization of Kai, which sounds like a really long title. And they were trying to think, if we started thinking about this from a kaupapa Māori point of view, what might we say about kai and then our connection to it through whakapapa? You know, foods like kumara have the ancestry to them that are in Māori narratives. And so it was trying to remember that and think about that. So there's some really interesting things there. So I think for Māori people in this particular kaupapa, often it's about reconnecting with that existing knowledge. And there are some amazing stories. I remember talking to somebody who was growing varieties of kumara in Rotorua and getting the Rotorua Boys High involved. And the particular varieties of kumara he was growing ones that were, you know, really old, that kumara particularly suited to that area of Te Arawa, you know, that they'd had for around 400 years. It was those old seeds. So they had a local connection to that. So kumara was really important for them. And then the other part of what Hayley and Hannah thought about was coloniality in relation to our thinking about food and nutrition. And they had a bit to say about that, the way in which colonial ways of thinking had impacted on people's relation to food. I just found reading their work really, really interesting, because I think part of the disconnection that we have today is because food is seen as a commodity to be grown so that it can be exported. And land has an economic value and food has an economic value, and people become losers in that particular system. From an academic point of view, reading their work was quite thought-provoking for me.
I think also that the conversations that you're touching on there are very relevant to many different cultures and people from different ethnicities and different ethnic backgrounds, because, I mean, again, with the UK perspective, but I'm sure it relates here as well, people from all over the world are trying to access foods that they know that mean something, that are socially and culturally acceptable. And especially in when they're accessing food from a food bank or a social supermarket, often that cultural aspect is lost. And so to them, whilst it may be nutritionally appropriate, it's not socially and culturally appropriate, which means everything to do with that food, whilst it's edible, doesn't meet their needs. So arguably that is not a sustainable approach. And so work is needed to move away from that. And I think where this question started was what could be done? Like, what could we do to make that shift happen, or to at least enable some of these organizations to move to a more kind of culturally and socially and nutritionally appropriate function? And I think the government does have a role to play. So government departments and agencies and funders can do more to support these organizations to become more sustainable, providing a more sustainable source of income, for example, or enabling them to apply for funding that is more extended, so that these organizations can provide that emergency food, but also do the work needed to become more sustainable. So looking at delivering more kind of holistic solutions, looking at community well-being, community development, cultural and social aspects, and enabling that food system in that local context to become more stronger, more resilient, and also consider that need that people have to have connection to their food. So growing, education, the historical aspects and the cultural importance of that. But as well as the government, I think food hubs and organizations themselves have a role to play in pulling together that evidence of their impact, which I realize relies on having the resource to do that. But if they were able to kind of make a compelling case to highlight their impacts on kind of food security, planetary and human health, justice, sustainability and inclusive growth and everything in between, then potentially that funding and that move to a more sustainable approach will be more likely given by governments. So I think there's a bit of a chicken and egg situation, but I think we both, like from a ground up and a top-down approach, things need to happen to enable organizations and communities to work together to shift in a way that's more sustainable and meets the needs of the people that this food is there to support, and also ensure that community and cultural aspects are not lost.
Sure. Yeah, at the moment, I'm really interested in those community-led, iwi-led solutions because I'm a bit, how can I say this? I just don't know if our current government are viewing food through a food sovereignty lens. I'm so interested in some of the work that our community groups are doing in spite of the government rather than because of the government. And an example of that is what happened with the Food in Schools program, the Ka Ora Ka Ako. So really cool program, started in response to COVID and in response to child poverty and those indicators. And actually, you know, we've got good evidence from the Growing Up in New Zealand study, a longitudinal study done in Auckland, and those children around, I can't remember how many they've got in their cohort. It might have been 5,000 children born in Auckland. They're around 13, 14 years old now, and following them. And that study looked at food security. So are the kids having enough to eat? And obviously, quite a lot of that cohort are not. And what we know is that Food in Schools program was reaching about a quarter of the people that it might have needed to from that particular cohort. So based on that evidence, those researchers said, actually, you need to increase the amount of schools that are getting the Food in Schools program. And so just that current decision of the government in terms of who is provisioning, I think that's been a loss for our local food sovereignty because, say, for example, in some of those more isolated areas, it was local suppliers working really hard to supply the school, and they were being funded to do that from the government. You know, I read on Radio New Zealand there was a Māori woman in Whanganui with her large māra supplying a school. So nice local food for the kids, and they can have feedback on the menu and things like that. And now it's all gone to one national provider, you know, so you can get $3 per head. Part of me cried actually when I learnt that, because I think it's a step backwards for food sovereignty. So I do think how the government is thinking and defining this is really important. And if they're only thinking about food from a really narrow, kids are getting enough protein lens, it's narrow and it's not thinking more broadly about who is supplying that food, where's that food come from, how can we make sure Ngata College in Ruatoria gets local food, or are we just going to make it all in Auckland, put it on trucks? So I think definitions are important. That's where I was getting to with that particular little rant.
Yes, Christina, I really think that you've highlighted something really relevant there. We're talking about the need for government policy to support food sovereignty, but the intentions of providing food security and, you know, coming with very positive intentions to support, you know, vulnerable families can then look like, in some cases, what you're talking about, removing some of that local connectivity, and by a government program coming in with a national perspective, the centralization of things can override what we're ultimately seeking, which is very, very local resilience and food sovereignty on a local level. And I think it's a massive challenge for the government to look across the, you know, the breadth of the entire country and be able to facilitate that to grow and look different in many different places. Food sovereignty will look slightly different everywhere, as it's a neighbourhood level thing, for food to be grown in the neighbourhood, shared in the neighbourhood. Something that I wanted to, again, ask you is that we've spoken about the need for government policy to provide more funding and structure and support to food sovereignty, and the need for grassroots organisations, neighbourhoods to be getting into that space as well. Something that we haven't touched on is where do we see the role of business and supermarkets, because the supermarket lobby is huge. The influence they have in terms of, you know, the weight of their business as an employer and as an economic player in the country is massive. And we know that they operate for profit. And I think that there's a lot of control and power that they have over the way our food system works. And I think that their engagement both with the government end of policy and the grassroots level of food sovereignty is not very clear and is quite a sticky question. From a food rescue perspective, I can absolutely put my hands up and say I respect the efforts that most supermarket chains are making to sell more and more of their produce to avoid waste. That is increasing and we even support that. But that's quite a different question from what we're actually talking about with food sovereignty and the roles of supermarkets in our overall food system.
I think going to that question as well, it's like part of the reason we have so much food waste is because there's so much choice. It's like, are we as a community willing to let the supermarkets reduce the choice? Who has that choice to make in terms of who can control what supermarkets sell? Because arguably, as you said, in a free market, they can arguably do what they like within remit of the policies and kind of governance structures that they are operating in. But I think, yeah, part of the food waste issue is to do with choice. And having less choice would help to reduce the amount of food waste that exists. And I think there's also issues around government legislation as well, to do with like best before dates, sell by dates, labels in general. And I think governments also have a role to play in that space. So I think if we move away from the best before, sell by dates and move towards an approach where we are more consciously aware of what food looks like when it is edible and when it's not edible, and supermarkets can offer support with that, then I think that would help to move away from the food waste issues. In terms of supermarkets and their role in food sovereignty, I think there is a lot of work to be done. And I think part of that is working more closely with local suppliers. But in a lot of places, there aren't local suppliers of all food. So like, you know, you might be able to access flour or rice or whatever it might be in that particular context, but then accessing local fruit and vegetables or local meats or local things like that is harder. But also, I guess with that, it's moving towards more like frozen food, more seasonal foods, which I have noticed here a lot more. So like seasonally foods change in price, whereas in the UK, it's like always the same. So we don't have any concept of what's seasonal, what's appropriate to be eating in March or in December and whatever month it might be. So I think that as well. So as well as the food waste and choice and labelling, there's also kind of seasonality of food and potentially more scope there to work with local suppliers if we're looking at that approach.
What supermarkets are doing is really, really important because they are such an enormous player in the food industry. So a little change that a supermarket will do could potentially have a huge impact if all of Foodstuffs and all of Progressive decide to, you know, say, for example, when they decided not to have plastic bags, enormous impact. Just because they're so big, Countdown, although they've changed their name now, haven't they? They were worse. I think they did think quite carefully about sustainability and did have a bit of a strategy there and, you know, should be commended for that work. I think in New Zealand, they are just so powerful because there are only two of them. And I do know they work a lot to try and reduce the food waste, but they also sell a lot of Coke in plastic bottles as well.
I think you're right in terms of like, yes, we should be commending supermarkets, but arguably they're a business and like, should it be their responsibility to promote health? Like, is it really up to them to do it? And also like relying on organizations like supermarkets or other food manufacturers or restaurants to voluntarily change their approaches and their policies to something that's more health promoting, more affordable, more sustainable, isn't necessarily going to work. Like research that I've been doing recently looks at kind of public-private partnerships and voluntary initiatives. And whilst like some things sound good, like reducing salt in own brand products, for example, if you still continuously purchase and sell products from across all different brands, then there necessarily isn't going to result in that widespread positive change that you're mentioning. So I think, yes, it's great that we see some positive things like supermarket plastic bags, for example. I think there is a need for governments to have some level of kind of policy influence, but also communities themselves have a massive role to play in arguing for and campaigning for change. Because if we keep going to supermarkets and keep buying the same things, nothing's ever going to change. I think unless there's a kind of, again, that bottom-up and top-down approach, there's no reason for supermarkets to do anything different. It'll just continue as is, unless there's something drastically shifts.
Well, speaking of the initiative that communities need to take, I was curious to know if either of you, Gemma or Christina, have any sense of, I might use the word hierarchy, even though I hesitate to do it, around the impact of different types of community-led food initiatives. So, Gemma, you were saying that there's so many different forms they can take. And I wondered if either of you consistently see that some forms are more impactful than others. For example, whether neighbourhood patapakai are regularly more effective in bringing, you know, positive outcomes for nutrition and community than, say, a community cafe. Just, you know, I'm not supposing that that's true, just, you know, to give you the idea of what I'm asking.
So the toolkit that we produced from this research basically offers a way in which organisations can systematically evaluate their impacts across social sustainability, environment, health, and economic kind of aspects in order for them to understand where their impacts are, but also to help them communicate better about what they're doing and how they can move to a more sustainable approach. And from that work and visiting lots of different organisations of lots of different types, all across the UK, and speaking to organisations, well, across the world, really, doing similar work, what has become evident is organisations that have a more kind of social enterprise model, so whereby they are also generating revenue, as well as offering kind of a charitable branch of their work, are more sustainable, and that enables them to be more impactful. And also there's a kind of co-location and collaboration of services. So where there's like a central organization. So for example, in the UK, there's one called the Active Wellbeing Society, which is based in Birmingham, which is a really big city in the UK. And they act as almost like an anchor organization. They undertake the funding bids and they have the staff and resources to be able to do that. And then they give and work with smaller organizations that are context specific, locally based, to give them the funding or to work with them to enable them to access funding so that they can offer those kind of specific services in their specific locations. But then the Active Wellbeing Society has that central anchor system. They are working directly with policymakers, they are working directly with governments, and they can see that kind of bigger picture whilst also working with these smaller organizations to reduce that resource limitation. And also ensure that work is not being necessarily replicated, but is being done in a way that is sustainable and also is funded in a way that can continue into the future. So I think that kind of organisation is really great and can help other small organisations to become more sustainable as well.
Oh, Gemma, that does sound really interesting. And I would genuinely be very interested in following up, because I see a lot of amazing work done by our communities, but it's often underfunded, it often relies on one champion. I think if there's ways in which the impact could be measured so that people don't get burnt out, that would be really brilliant. I think there are some good examples from Te Reo Māori, especially in Māori Health. One of the most interesting things that the Whānau Order policy did was it has Whānau Order commissioning agencies. So in the South Island, for example, there's an organisation called Te Pūtahi Tāna o Te Waipainamu. It's got representatives from all the iwi of the South Island, the aid up in Nelson and then Ngāitahu. So government funding goes directly to that organisation, but Māori are in charge of the way in which the funding is delivered through Māori providers into Māori communities. I mean, I think in the Māori space, having a degree of Māori control and a say and where funds go to is really, really important. I mention it in this context because they've funded really cool food initiatives, gardening initiatives, and food production kind of marae-based aunties making pickle kind of projects, coming from a kai sovereignty point of view.
I'm sure that we could keep chatting for another hour, but we're running out of time. So as we wind up, is there anything you'd like to say as a kind of final reflection?
J, just to say, I think these organisations are doing great work. I think that shouldn't be forgotten. And I think there's also a need to look at scaling up and out of these organisations, but also scaling deep. So looking at the root causes of the need to access them. And I think that's also come up from this conversation is there's a role of communities, organisations and the government in supporting communities to access food that they need.
I was involved in reviewing a document that the Public Health Advisory, I think that's their name, did about the food system. And it's on there on the Ministry of Health website. You won't have heard of it because I think they kept it pretty quiet because some of the recommendations of the report were directly in opposite to current government policy. And so I do think we know in public health, the food system is broken and there's a lot of things the government could be doing. And some of those great reports being written, great recommendations, which I think we just need some political will backed by community.
Yeah, absolutely. I would totally call that to say we need to see that political will and that that has to sit hand in hand with the community level of things developing in its own way and understanding that whilst it may be towards a similar direction, it will look different and diverse in every place, and that that's part of what we are seeking is a unity in our direction, but a diversity in the way that each type of food sovereignty manifests in its location.
Amazing. Thank you all so much. Tēnā koutou. Gemma, it's been great having your kind of overall impact lens, and Christina, your knowledge of what's going on with various Māori communities and initiatives has been great, and Louisa, that real on the ground perspective of the work that your organizations are doing. I think this has worked really well in terms of the three different perspectives coming together, and I think we've done what we kind of set out to do, which was, despite the fact you've come from these three different points along this big spectrum or scale of food initiatives, there's so much overlap and parallels between them, and the seeking for that just world that we're all after, really underpinning everything. So thank you all so much.
Thank you, Sally, for bringing us together.
It's been cool to meet you both.
Que viva el huila, compadre! Dedicado a Campo Alegre. Siembra buena semilla y ponte a cosechar. Que en este mundo loco todo puede pasar. Pa' ti que cultivas campo, pa' ti que cultivas sueños, pa' ti que con tus manitas recoges el alimento, pa' ti es que elevo este canto, para que sientas aliento y sepas que no estás solo, hay mucho luchando el tiempo.
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será?
Que sangre inocente no corra más. El poder del pueblo llegue a reinar. ¡Vamos ahí!
¡Hey! Siembra el amor.
Siembra.
Siembra la conciencia.
Siembra.
Siembra la unidad.
Siembra.
Por un mañana mejor que empieza hoy. Por tus hijos.
Siembra.
Por tus nietos.
Siembra.
Por la vida.
Siembra.
Las manos llenas de tierra, armadas con un machete, alimentan a las familias del político que promete, del policía que los somete y de todos los que olvidamos que ellos no son guerrilleros, son las semillas y son el campo. ¡Hey! ¿Hasta cuándo nuestros hermanos de la tierra perdiendo su nido? ¿Hasta cuándo los campesinos seguirán en el olvido? ¿Morirán la semilla y el agua con la mina y el monocultivo? Y en las manos del mal gobierno el alimento.
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será?
Que sangre inocente no corra más.
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será?
Que el poder del pueblo llegue a
a reinar. ¡Vamos ahí! Tengo el alma, porque crecí en esos campos, los mismos que por decreto hoy están aniquilando. No entienden que somos todos los que salimos perdiendo. Si hoy no mueren sus hijos, mañana serán sus nietos.
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será
que sangre inocente no corra más? Poder del pueblo llegue a reinar otra vez.
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será
que sangre inocente no corra más?
Ay, 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 ¿cuándo será
que el poder del pueblo llegue a reinar? ¡Sí, señor!
Vendiendo veneno a la humanidad, provocan el cáncer, semilla del mal. Venenos transgénicos, todos tan ciegos, ciegos de poder. Destruyen el campo y la tierra también. ¿Cómo se puede atentar a la vida? ¿Cómo se puede alterar la comida? Cuida a tus hijos y a tu familia de la destrucción de los herbicidas. El ser humano colmó la paciencia, perdió la razón y provoca tristeza. Muchas personas no tienen conciencia y no respetan la naturaleza. Cántalo, mi hermano, que quede grabado. Estamos viviendo un peligro real. Unámonos todos para no olvidar que hay que destruir la semilla del mal.
Sí, señor.
Se llegó la hora de decir basta ya, no más guerra. Las madres colombianas no estamos dispuestas a seguir pariendo y criando hijos para la guerra.